Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and let's get right to our week in review. This week, State Gaming Commission Chief Stephen Crosby says he regrets attending a private party hosted at Suffolk Downs. That raised calls for his resignation, but Crosby says he's staying put.
I still think it was a really minor matter, but it didn't pass the appearance sniff test. That was a mistake.
Also, three friends of marathon bombing suspect Jahar Tsarnaev will be tried separately over charges they destroyed evidence and lied to police.
We're glad that this case is severed and he'll have a separate trial on its own merits so we can present his case in and of itself.
And this commencement season, student outcry over nearly a dozen high-profile speakers.
This has been a tipping point. It will spark much-needed debate on who has a voice to speak on campus.
And 10 years ago, just this weekend, Massachusetts becomes the first state in the nation to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples.
I now pronounce you wife and wife, or husband and husband. I now pronounce you married.
All right, so quite a lot to talk about in our week in review, and joining me now to do so is Adrian Walker, columnist for the Boston Globe. Hi there, Adrian.
Hey, how are you?
Good, great to have you. Also with us is Shannon O'Brien, former state treasurer. She joins us here in the studio. Shannon, great to see you again as well.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you too. So let's jump right into it and start off with the latest on Steve Crosby, the head of the state's gaming commission. Five gubernatorial candidates have called for him to resign after he was spotted at a private party at Suffolk Downs on opening day. Suffolk Downs, of course, being one of the locations that's vying for a Boston area casino license. That was also in the wake of the fact that he waited a year to disclose his relationship with a landowner of the Everett site where a casino might be built. So this week, Stephen Crosby says he's not stepping down as chairman of the Gaming Commission, but will recuse himself from any decisions regarding Boston.
You know, I've said many times that the integrity of this process is the most important thing for me and for the commission. The appearance of integrity and the reality of integrity. I've honored that commitment by recusing myself, even though neither I nor any of the commissioners think there's any question about my ability to be objective about this process. With that, I'm going to go on and do the rest of the work of the commission. The other four commissioners can handle their Region A work fine, and I think that's the best way to go.
So, Adrian Walker, let's start with you. I mean, we just heard Stephen Crosby say that the appearance of integrity is the most important thing, but yet he went to this party at Suffolk Downs. He's got a long history in public service. How do you square those two things having happened, you know, to the same guy?
I really don't think you can square them. And, I think if the appearance of integrity and impartiality is the most important thing, then Steve Crosby should step down as chair of the commission.
And so, Shannon, let me turn to you. You've been in state government. I mean, is this a major oversight by Steve Crosby?
I think it is a significant oversight. And, you know, a lot of people don't know. This gambling issue, this isn't the past 5 years, 10 years, even 15 years. This issue has been going on in Massachusetts on and off for 40 years. The potential amount of money that's at stake for whomever wins these licenses is huge. And so the opportunity for lawsuits that could slow this down and potentially even mess up the whole status of gaming in this state that was, you know, originally passed. So I like Steve Crosby. You know, I've worked with him when I was state treasurer, and I think he does have a lot of integrity. And the fact that he paid for himself to go to that party means that he understood that there might be an issue there. And the problem is, I think that, and I agree with Adrian, the appearance just makes it very, very difficult for him to continue in this role.
Okay, so do you think his recusal from any greater Boston area decisions is enough to smooth over the appearance problem issue?
I think that the appearance is the problem. And the fact that they do have four remaining members of this commission that are, as they've said, in sync, and they generally agree, and they generally vote in a unanimous fashion, does not mean that it doesn't raise some questions for some disgruntled, you know, suitor for one of these licenses to file a lawsuit and to really create some problems going forward.
Right. So, Adrian, let me turn back to you. I mean, I heard you say earlier that you think that Steve Crosby possibly should step down entirely. But what about just the fact that he has recused himself from Boston area decisions? Same question to you. Do you think that that's enough to get him through this rough patch right now?
Well, I agree with Shannon. I think it's clearly not going to be enough to satisfy the critics, and they are certainly going to be critics no matter what the outcome of this process is. I mean, this Gaming Commission has had one problem after another, and this is not his first apparent conflict of interest. And, you know, I'm just, as somebody who has also known Steve Crosby a long time, I'm really surprised by the lack of judgment he's shown here. And, no, I don't think the recusal really does go far enough. I think he probably needs to step down.
Mm. Nevertheless, Governor Deval Patrick is sticking by Steve Crosby. He said just yesterday that calls for Crosby's resignation were premature and political.
I know that there are a lot of people making calls, and I've said I'm not, you know, a lot of that is politics. I get it. I think it was the right thing to do for him to recuse himself, not because he had violated the rules, but because of the concerns about appearance.
So, Adrian, let me turn back to you. I mean, the governor does have a history of showing loyalty to folks that he has appointed, you know, to,
yes,
to a certain degree, which is understandable. They're members of his administration. But do you think the governor here is maybe showing a little too much loyalty?
I think the governor is guilty at times of a little too much loyalty. But I think there's also concern about what would happen if he did resign. I mean, you'd have a four-member commission that could deadlock 2-2 on some important issue. And is it really feasible for somebody else to come in and pick up Crosby's work at this point in time? I mean, I think there are a lot of considerations from the governor's standpoint.
And Shannon, what do you think about the fact that the governor said this is all politics right now?
Well, it's not really politics. It's mistakes have been made. And again, it's politics in that there are a number of entities, a number of groups, a number of large businesses that are all vying for these licenses. And so when some of them feel aggrieved by this process, by the mistakes that have been made, I think that it undermines the overall appearance of whether or not the ultimate awarding of the licenses will be done in a fashion that was without any sort of conflict.
Right. And before we move on to another piece of our
I don't understand
review,
how hard it would be to appoint someone else to be the chair. And maybe I'd ask Adrian what he thinks of that. Do you think this would be very hard for someone else to become? I mean, again, there's hearings and there's different, different processes and lots of testimony to go through. But what do you think, Adrian? Do you think that maybe someone else could be appointed to be chair? Does it have to be a four-person commission if he were to step down?
I think that's a great question. I really don't know. I would assume that somebody could step in at this point.
Yeah.
We're pretty deep into the process, but
yeah,
anybody can be replaced.
Yeah. Here's a question I want have for both of you before we move on to the next story of the week, and that's something we were wondering about here. I mean, as you mentioned a little earlier, Shannon, this process, not just the commission, but the whole story of casino gambling in Massachusetts has been going on for so very, very long. It has been so fraught and contentious the whole time, and now we have this in the very commission that's supposed to be making these final decisions about where these casinos are going. We just started wondering all over again if casino gambling is sort of doomed in Massachusetts, or if there's a hex on this, as a whole.
Well, it's, again, there's so much money at stake for one of these licenses, for one of these businesses, although not as much money as, say, when Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun, to be the first casinos, there was a lot more money at stake. And you're seeing the number of them, their revenues are kind of, turning off a little bit, if you will. The fact is, it's cyclical. In bad economic times, the casinos become something that people want because they see the jobs, they see the revenues, they see the taxes. I don't know. I mean, but there's always that undercurrent that people are uncomfortable with any type of expanded gaming.
Yeah. Adrian, a quick thought from you on that?
Shannon, one of the things that's happened is that in all of the years that we've been talking about this and the deliberating and forming commissions and so on, the amount of money in casino gambling in Massachusetts has probably gone down substantially.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, there's less money in it now than there was 10 years ago, right?
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, and I mean, for those who don't necessarily have to have a table to play at, there's still always the Massachusetts lottery, if I point that out. But let's move on to, and it's $30 scratch tickets now, but let's move on to the latest news regarding the Boston Marathon bombings, and that has to do with pre-trial hearings of three friends of suspected bomber Jahar Tsarnaev. These three UMass Dartmouth students have been charged with destroying evidence and lying to police, and they were in federal court this week with a number of defense motions, including asking for a change of venue and suppression of evidence. They did not get the change of venue motion, so they will be tried in Boston, albeit separately. Here's attorney Nicholas Woodridge, who represents Asmat Tazayakov, and I think I just ruined his name, and I apologize for that, so I'll try it again later. But here's his attorney.
You know, I mean, we made a motion for a change of venue, and I think that's something that you have to do. So I hope Boston is able to be impartial and render us a fair verdict.
Okay, again, that's attorney Nicholas Woodridge, who represents Asmat Tazayakov. So, Shannon, let's start with you. Do you think that these three young men can get a fair trial or trials in Boston?
I think that they can. However, I do think that here in Boston, you know, where emotions have run high, you know, about the marathon bombings, it may be difficult to seat an impartial jury. But that being said, I do believe that they can get a fair trial here.
Adrian, the federal judge who decided on these motions basically said it's not where that matters, but who gets impaneled. And he seemed to have confidence that an impartial jury can be found here.
I think you can impanel 12 impartial people here. I don't think there's any reason to change the venue for this trial.
At all?
No, I really don't.
Okay. Well, what about the fact that we learned this week also from text messages that were released in court that Jahar Tsarnaev joked with a friend hours after the FBI released his photo as a possible suspect in the bombing investigation? And after the photo was released, according to these court documents, Tsarnaev wrote to his friend, one of these young men who's also facing trial now, "Better not text me," and then LOL. Anything to be read from these, Shannon?
I think what you have is a number of very young, very naive, and very potentially evil people. But mostly, I think these guys, you know, in the, you know, from UMass Dartmouth, were young. It's almost like kids playing a video game where they really don't even understand how real this really is. I think that they have deluded themselves into thinking that this is, you know, almost funny to them at this point in time. And that's going to be very interesting as all of this does come out.
Especially since funny has landed them in federal court facing federal charges. Adrian, you have a thought on that?
Yeah, I bet they're not laughing now. But yes, I was struck too by the fact that it almost doesn't seem real to them. It's like they think they're in some kind of buddy movie or something.
Hmm. Well, let's move on to sort of an interesting story that's happening nationwide, but definitely resonates here in Massachusetts, because it is college graduation season. But this year, there have been a rash of rescinded offers to commencement speakers. Nearly a dozen high-profile commencement speakers, ranging from former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice to International Monetary Fund Chief Christine Lagarde, have actually had their speeches canceled following student protests. Now, Lagarde is the first woman to head the IMF. She pulled out of Smith College's commencement after students complained that the IMF, and this is a quote, has led directly to the strengthening of imperialist and patriarchal systems that oppress and abuse women worldwide. So here's a response from Smith College President Kathleen McCarthy.
I think we are seeing a disturbing trend, and I've been describing it as a lack of tolerance for a wide variety of views.
So, Shannon, let's start with you. Is it a sign of a lack of tolerance on campus?
I absolutely agree that it's a sign of a lack of tolerance. And I also think it's a sign of the strength of social media in terms of creating, generating, and expressing disagreement in a very public way. Of course, I remember sitting, you know, at the dining room at Yale University and hearing that Carl Sagan was going to be the class day speaker when I was graduating from Yale many years ago. And I could hear two students talking, and they were saying, "Oh, you know who he is. Who's Carl Sagan? Oh, he's that famous cosmetologist." So anyway, when you have not a cosmetologist or a cosmologist, but someone, you know, like, you know, Christine Lagarde, you know, or any of the speakers that have been turned down, I think it's crazy, even if you don't like what they have to say.
Yeah, but Adrian, your thought on that, and nevertheless, colleges are acquiescing to a lot of these student protests.
If the first female to lead the IMF can't speak at the commencement at Smith College. Really, who's going to be safe here? But, you know, we're in an era where students think of themselves as consumers and they expect to have a voice in these things. And I don't think, you know, I don't think that's going to be the end of this. I think this is a trend that's going to continue.
But I'm just wondering why colleges, I mean, okay, so students think of themselves as consumers. Does that mean that college administrators are thinking of themselves as of selling a product, so therefore they have to keep the customer happy? There's no,
well, I think they just all want Will Ferrell. You know?
It's been interesting to see how quickly the colleges have folded. I mean, at the first sign of protest, they seem to be willing to back down.
Now, this is what really gets me, because colleges and universities are supposed to be, you know, traditionally one of the places in this country where open debate, a variety of ideas.
Sparking intellectual debate of ideas.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes, exactly.
The fact that you know, you have a civil discussion with a variety of people that you may not necessarily agree with. But this is exactly the opposite of what's happening. I mean, I don't want to read too much into this, but Shannon, your thoughts on the fact that it does this signal really a shift overall in what, you know, students think that they should be getting out of college?
No, I don't think that it's a shift in terms of what they're getting out. Again, I think it's really the mechanics of how they express it, how quickly they do it, and how publicly they do it, and that the universities just don't want to have problems at graduation time. They just want to, I think, make sure that this is a happy day for everyone, and they send them off. I again, not necessarily remembering what Carl Sagan said at my graduation. I think that a lot of people, you know, would like to have someone who's going to be giving them, you know, something big and important to think about when they graduate. But you know what? Probably a lot more people do think, what did Will Ferrell say, or what did Oprah say? You know, and that's almost that's kind of sad too.
If people who've been disagreed with can't be commencement speakers, commencements are going to be awfully boring.
Yeah,
I'll
you're
say
right.
That.
They verge on boring as it is.
Verge.
Sorry to all the people about to go to commencement out there. I've been to many in my lifetime. Some of them were great, others. But anyway, congratulations to you all, graduates of the class of 2014. All right, let's move on to the 10-year anniversary of a moment for civil rights, which began here in Massachusetts. And that is the fact that Massachusetts 10 years ago tomorrow began issuing marriage licenses for same-sex couples. And on Wednesday, we spoke with Susan Shepherd and Marsha Hams. They were the first same-sex couple in Massachusetts to get a marriage license at Cambridge City Hall. They were in line first. And 10 years later, they spoke with us on Radio Boston. Here's Marsha Hams.
It really was the beginning of that feeling that we could just talk naturally about our relationship as heterosexual couples do, and really have that mean something to the people that we were talking to and to ourselves. It's constantly reinforced every day that you say, my wife Susan, my wife, I'm going, you know,
right,
out somewhere with my wife Susan. Which you would never, I just never said before.
So, Adrian, let me start with you. 10 years later, the question of same-sex marriage is a settled one here in Massachusetts. But as we were doing our homework and looking back on that date back in 2004, we were reminded about what a huge event it was, and how you know, the country, not entirely, but has moved quite a bit in the decade since May 17th, 2004.
It's amazing how far the country has come in just 10 years. I mean, it's a bona fide revolution, and I think this is a great, proud moment for Massachusetts. It's great that we were the first state to do this.
Shannon, your thoughts?
I'm just excited because I'm picking out what wardrobe I'm going to wear next week when Cam and Mitchell get married on Modern Family. You know, and that's like the most controversial thing about it is what color shoes you're going to wear. I mean, I was there 25 years ago as a young legislator when we voted on gay civil rights and when we voted on, you know, adoption by gay couples. And I can remember being counseled by a number of people, many of whom, you know, were very friendly towards, you know, civil rights and those kinds of things, counseling me against this tough political vote. And back then, you know, I can remember having advertising against me when I was a state representative for taking some of those votes. And now it's just such a regular thing. And I think that what Massachusetts has done, what Vermont has done, and in other states to kind of grow this into something that is not big news anymore is a tribute to the strength of this state, and I think that it's very important.
Well, we don't want to be too Pollyanna-ish about this, though, because if you do look across the United States, I mean, you could read it as a glass half full, half empty issue, because 33 states still ban same-sex marriage outright. There have been a slew of judicial rulings in recent months and years, including the fact that Arkansas just issued its first licenses. An Idaho judge struck down that state's prohibition. And on Wednesday, a court case was heard in Virginia legalizing same-sex marriage there. And there are also a raft of cases that are poised in federal courts around the country. Do you think, though, and I'll just turn this to you, Adrian, that even though we still have those 33 states that ban it outright, that legally we might be reaching that tipping point, that the next round of cases that make it to the Supreme Court, you know, we had the DOMA cases, but, you know, that we might actually see the constitutionality of these bans fully and openly challenged outright?
I do believe that's where this is headed, yes. The Supreme Court is ultimately going to have to resolve this. And I think they're going to resolve it the right way in favor of gay marriage. I think all of the bans are going to fall. It's just a matter of time.
Mm. And Shannon, this question just popped into my mind. I want to turn it to you. Because we have Massachusetts as serving as an example in two major sort of American milestones. One is the legalization of gay marriage. And the other, which has been frequently quoted, is Massachusetts was an example for the Affordable Care Act, mm-hmm. okay? Because we had universal care here in Massachusetts first. Two different major issues in the United States fought in two different ways, right? Same-sex marriage has been done state by state, roughly. The Affordable Care Act, of course, was one fell swoop across the nation. You could say that the successes of the two ideas is highly variable. I'm not comparing them necessarily, but it just shows that Massachusetts, as an incubator for ideas, it's really interesting about how what is successful and what's not as it spreads across the country.
Well, I mean, it did kind of spread. You know, you had Hawaii, you had Massachusetts, you know, and I'm sure there are other states I just can't recall, you know, who were passing these on a statewide basis. But the mechanics of one versus the other, one being a right, the other, you know, being an infrastructure, you know, makes that a lot more difficult. But absolutely, Massachusetts, you know, has been the incubator for a number of different important, you know, issues across the country. And the good news is the gay marriage issue does not require computers.
Right.
You know, probably.
Or websites. Yeah. Exactly. Precisely. Well, we've just got enough time now to wrap up the week with our hubbubs. And those are the stories that maybe didn't make it top of the fold, as some of us like to say. So, Adrian, let's start with you. What's your hubbub?
Well, they're filming Black Mass, the Whitey Bulger biopic, in Cambridge. And Triple O's Lounge, his famous headquarters, if you will, on Broadway, has been transplanted to the Polish American Club in Inman Square. I think that's just such a bizarre fake neighborhood to give Whitey Bulger.
Exactly. And I retweeted a picture of Johnny Depp in his full Whitey.
Oh my gosh, he looks awesome.
Whitey makeup.
Yes.
Yeah. I thought he looked pretty convincing, but I got some tweets back from people saying, have you ever seen Whitey in the flesh? That is not what he looks like. But anyway.
So who are your friends that are hanging around with Whitey Bulger in the flesh? That's the hubbub for me.
It's Johnny Depp underneath all of that stuff, too. Shannon, your hubbub.
And my hubbub is, what if they gave a revolution and no one showed up? Two very conservative Republican legislators called once again for stepping down of Brad Jones, the Republican minority leader, because he worked too hard in a bipartisan fashion to get things done on behalf of both his party and on the behalf of the people of the Commonwealth. And it's sort of like if a tree falls in the woods and no one is there, does anyone hear it? So I think that much ado about nothing.
Much ado about nothing. Wow. Well, so I am going to completely geek out for my hubbub this week. And in order to do so, Tim, our engineer, can we start with this?
Space, a final frontier.
Okay, so
these are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise.
Thank you, Captain. So this, I have to admit, this comes via Twitter from our friends at the MIT Alumni Association. They remind us that today is Space Day. And apparently, last year, an MIT alum took the Galileo, which was the original Star Trek shuttlecraft, And he had spent years and years, you know, basically refurbishing it from thruster to thruster, if I can say that. And it did it with his own money. Actually, took it to a shipyard in New Jersey, got it rebuilt. It looks beautiful, actually. And last year, when this project was completed, he donated it to the Houston Space Center, to the Visitor Center at Johnson Space Center, and it's there in one of the dining rooms. So again, this is a bit of an old news story made anew by the fact that today is Space Day, and I will always look for an excuse to play the Star Trek theme on this show, which I guess is really why I had that hubbub. So that's my hubbub for the day. And Shannon O'Brien, former state treasurer, always a pleasure to have you. Thanks so
Thank
much.
You.
And Adrian Walker, columnist for the Boston Globe. Great to talk to you as well, Adrian.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, stick with us because up next on the show, what would you do with a computer that could learn about your mental state and adapt accordingly? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.